Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, horror's best subgenre. We asked more than 500,000 horror fans online what their favorite or which subgenre they thought was best, and we're here with their answers and ours. I'm going to break tradition on this podcast a little bit and go over our pick first, and then we will cover the voting from the community after that. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I think my pick for horror's best subgenre might be a little bit of a cheat. Although, to be clear, I don't think it is, and I'm going to fight hard for it. But I didn't want to end the episode with this in case it was something that would leave some block of people unsatisfied. Psycho, Dracula, Frankenstein, The Shining, The Silence of the Lambs, The Mist, Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, and The Exorcist 3, Hellraiser, The Haunting of Hill House, Battle Royale, Jaws, It, I Am Legend. So you're probably asking yourself right now, what the hell kind of subgenre has all those movies in it? I'm going to be a little bit rebellious here and invent a subgenre, maybe. You may or may not agree with this when I'm done. But even if you don't agree, I don't want you to bow out of the discussion, because whether it's an actual subgenre or not, or whether you consider it not one and I consider it one, whatever, I believe it is. But that's not the important part. They say you never really miss something until it's gone. And I'm afraid that my favorite personal subgenre might just be running out of fuel. It might be withering on the vine from lack of material. And that worries me a lot. And I hope I'm wrong, but that's why I wanted to talk about this. Also, after we cover all of the voting, at the end of this episode, I'm going to give my pick for a more traditional of subgenre as my favorite. So what do I think is the best horror subgenre? It's horror movies based on books. If you went all the way back to the very beginning of horror movies, probably like 1896 with House of the Devil, and then took, I don't know, the two or three best horror movies from each year from then up to, let's say, the year 2000, and then you took all the names of those movies that you pulled and wrote them down and stuck them on a dartboard, the chances are every other dart you threw would land on the title of a horror movie adapted from a novel or a short story. But if you did that exact same thing with the two or three best horror movies from, let's say, the year 2010 to now, you'd probably have to throw a lot of darts before you started hitting the names of movies that came from books or stories. And if Stephen King and Mike Flanagan didn't exist, good luck. Mike Flanagan is almost single-handedly carrying on this tradition with excellent adaptations of Gerald's Game and of Dr. Sleep, both from Stephen King, but he also did Haunting of Hill House, which comes from the magnificent Shirley Jackson. He's doing Turning of the Screw, which is from the amazing Henry James. And he's got the upcoming Fall of the House of Usher from the godfather of horror, Edgar Allan Poe. But aside from Mike Flanagan kind of holding back the dark there, it seems to be happening less and less. And here's where I noticed it. One of the listeners of this podcast very helpfully messaged our Facebook page and prompted me to start making lists on Letterboxd of the voting that we do on these podcast episodes, which was a great idea. I don't know why I didn't think of it. And when I was looking at our previous episode of the best horror movies of 2022, we picked five. And then I thought about what would we have picked for 2021. It jumped out to me that the only movies that were adapted from novels or short stories that I would have considered there, even touching that best category, would have probably been Fear Street and maybe the remake of Candyman, if you count that. But none of the rest of the top picks were from books. And then the more I thought about it, the more kind of worried I got, because let's face it, Stephen King's old, right? So I hear a lot about how there's a renaissance in horror fiction recently, how there's a lot of great young talent, great emerging talent, and that's true, absolutely. But is it translating to the screen? So it seems to me that if we looked at the new crop of horror writers post King, Barker, Peter Straub, or even not necessarily horror writers, just writers who do a general kind of fiction and then stray into the horror realm, kind of like William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist, did. He was a comedy writer before he wrote The Exorcist. The main talents that jump out are Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, obviously, Adam Neville, John Lindquist, the author of Let the Right One In, among others, Josh Malerman, the author of Bird Box, and Paul Tremblay, the author of A Head Full of Ghosts and A Knock at the Cabin. Well, his book was Cabin at the End of the Woods, but that's the movie it became, and that's the one that really got me thinking, because that movie was not great, at least to me, and I also definitely wouldn't consider Bird Box even close to the best horror movie of the year it came from. So unless I'm missing something, you got to go all the way back to 2017 to Adam Neville, the adaptation from his book The Ritual, which was an amazing horror movie, maybe my favorite from that year. So that's 5 years. That's half a decade since we've gotten a home run movie from the adaptations of the new crop of horror talent. I mean, Fear Street was amazing, but that's not new crop. R.L. Stine's not new to anybody. Now, to have to go from figuring out, I mean, Misery from Stephen King's novel might have been the best horror movie of 1990. Silence of the Lambs from Thomas Harris' novel might have been the best horror movie of 1991. Candyman and Bram Stoker's Dracula were vying for top spot in 92, both from literature. To go from that to like a 5 year gap now from an excellent horror movie from one of the, you know, at the, in the rise of their career horror talents, the way Barker and King were in the late 80s, early 90s, Thomas Harris, etc. This is, I got to admit, a little concerning to me. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not one of those people that's doom and gloom about horror in general. To the open minded horror fan, one that's not completely stuck in the fast, I think the health and state of horror right now is pretty strong. As I'm recording this, Talk to Me is tearing up the box office, at least relative to its budget. It's already made more than its budget in one weekend. And any genre that can kick up things as diverse as Fear Street and Phil Tippett's Mad God, not to mention TV series like Midnight Mass, that's a genre that's doing pretty good. But I'd hate to see horror movies based on books dwindle away to nothing, particularly the new stuff. I mean, let's face it, I know it's hard to think about like this, but when Brian De Palma adapted Stephen King's Carrie, Stephen King was like up and coming, right? He wasn't like an institution the way he is now. And movies based on up and coming writers now seem to be few and far between. And there are a lot of reasons for this, right? And I respect that. I mean, the ideas come from creepypasta. Ideas come from AI, God knows now. I think I even heard about a horror movie that's being made just based on like a freaking Twitter thread or X thread or whatever the hell you call that now. And as long as the movies that come out of that are good, great. But like I said, I hope this particular subgenre doesn't go away entirely, because I'll miss it if it's gone. One other amazing thing to note about this is it seems like the floor of this subgenre, if you accept it as a subgenre like I do, is way higher than the floor of a lot of other subgenres. So what do I mean by that? Well, bad slasher movies are bad. They're really bad. Bad paranormal movies like Poltergeist are bad. I mean, fun, sure, but really terrible. But even the not quite top tier or lesser known horror movies based on books just seem to be a higher quality, or at least it seems that way to me. Let me give you some examples. I kind of built a list here. The Amityville Horror, Interview with the Vampire, 30 Days of Night, Devil's Advocate, American Psycho, Silver Bullet, A Stir of Echoes, I Know What You Did Last Summer, The Howling, Angel Heart, Something Wicked This Way Comes, John Carpenter's Vampires, Maximum Overdrive. I mean, even one of my favorite older horror movies of all time, Todd Browning's Freaks, is based on a short story. The Wicker Man, Needful Things. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But the point is, the quality of those, taken as like a strata of horror films, is so much higher than a lot of the other subgenres' medium efforts. So not only does the category of horror movies based on books contain a lot of the greatest horror movies ever made, it's also kind of preventative of making movies that are just outright awful. And there's a pretty specific reason for that, right? Like, if an author takes years to gestate an idea and research it and, you know, fight through the hard times of being alone in a room, just writing down their thoughts, and they get that book out there, and the book somehow succeeds enough to catch people's attention to turn it into a movie, there's already been enough work put into that that if you're even trying to be faithful to it at all, you're probably going to make something pretty decent. I was thinking about doing an episode on this podcast at some point of the best horror movies of the year so far. Not sure I want to do that yet. Maybe I'll just save it for the end of the year, but I might. So I haven't put a lot of thought into this yet. I like to come to the podcast episodes fresh and not like pre-think it a lot. But I just to make the point, I Googled a list of, just randomly picked a list of the best horror movies of 2023 so far. And it comes up Evil Dead Rise, Megan, The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, Skinamarink, The Blackening, Infinity Pool, Scream 6, Sick, and The Boogeyman. And it goes on and on, The Pope's Exorcist, etc. But none of these are based on books. I mean, I guess The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster is sort of from Mary Shelley, so I take a lot of heart at that. But otherwise, it's looking pretty bleak, at least in terms of my favorite subgenre. And the last thing I want to say about this before we get to the community's voting about subgenres is, when you think about stuff like this, sometimes it leads down to some treasure at the end of some tunnels. One of my absolute favorite horror books I've ever read, ever purchased, it's a beautiful edition, beautiful cover, great introduction from Stephen King. It's called The Rim of the Morning, and it's a collection of two longer works by William Sloan. The first one titled To Walk the Night, and the second one titled The Edge of Running Water. People message the Horror Weekly pages all the time saying, do you have recommendations for horror movies that are actually scary that might scare me? And even a little more rarely, but still, do you have suggestions for books that are scary? Well, scary is really subjective. Like, what scares me isn't necessarily going to scare you, and vice versa. So obviously, you can only speak for yourself when you answer a question like that. But despite the fact that Edge of Running Water is an older tale, I remember going on an overnight hike once by myself, foggy, and reading this kind of in the breaks, or like, I'll admit, I read when I walk, I'm a maniac. So this one really got under my skin and was very unsettling and still packed a very eerie punch. So naturally, given the idea of this episode, I was thinking, man, I wish someone would adapt either of these stories, but preferably Edge of Running Water, into a movie. I would love to see it. So just idly I searched, and lo and behold, there actually was an adaptation of this already done. Even more remarkably, it's obviously a movie I hadn't seen, but it's starring the ineffable Boris Karloff, and it's from 1941, so circa the same time as Universal's Wolfman. I was all in just hearing about all this. So I got the movie and watched it. And does it do justice to my experience of Edge of Running Water, the story, not really, especially not in the second half so much, but it's still a pretty damn good movie. I had so much fun watching it. It has such a unique atmosphere because it's based on a really unique story. Karloff does an incredible job of just falling the fuck apart throughout this movie, like his character does in the story. And honestly, it is kind of unnerving. There's a collection of dead bodies being yoked to this insane idea. And when they, like, use the bodies in the, scientific / occult ceremony they're doing, they're kind of pulled in. They lean forward. It's very creepy as a visual. Karloff's sidekick, his Igor in this movie, is really tragic. It's someone that would just meant all the good in the world and then were brought to this low, horrid point by Karloff. The murders escalate even despite Karloff's kind of intention. And then the Mrs. Walters character kind of becomes a full-blown Lady Macbeth situation and pays a pretty awful price for it. It's a great movie. So if you haven't seen The Devil Commands and you have a taste for older horror movie classics, definitely check it out. But even more so, the William Sloan story, if you're a reader, is just absolute dark magic. But this is the kind of thing I love. It's like coming to a movie like Angel Heart and realizing that it's based on a novel called Falling Angel, which is tremendous. Or in this case, discovering The Devil Commands and just finding a twofer, right? You got a great movie and a great book. So that's the reason I'm willing to die on this hill of horror movies coming from books or stories being a fascinating subgenre. Okay, let's get into the voting from the community. Actually, I realized that I misspoke Paul Tremblay's title of his novel. I called it Cabin at the End of the Woods. It's actually The Cabin at the End of the World, which is a much better title than A Knock at the Cabin. But apparently to horror fans, when you say the word cabin, it's mandatory you say the word woods next. And also, there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of other talented, up-and-coming or semi-established horror authors out there that didn't get mentioned in the names previously. But the reason is that the names I went with are the ones who are the only ones who seem to be getting their stuff turned into any kind of major movies at all. But there are lots of other great authors out there, like Kelly Link or Lisa Tuttle or John Langan. It would be amazing to see someone try to attempt to make a movie out of The Fisherman. Thomas Ligotti, Laird Barron. I mean, it's just great to have so much good stuff to read. Okay, now with the voting, this is the first time this ever happened on this podcast. It's like a 10-way tie. There was no winner. Everything's just clustered. It's amazing how the community here has such a broad range of genres that they pin as their favorite or think are the best. Every time in the past when we've done a vote like what's the best horror movie of the 2010s or the 1980s or what's the scariest horror movie scene of all time, etc., in our past episodes, there's always been a clear winner, either a little by little or by a lot. Let me give some of the comments from the voting, and then I'll try to unpack some of this. So let's start with subscribers first, people from the subscriber group that support this effort. John Chadwick said, "I like a good ghost story." And Cindy Buttress said, "This is tough to pick just one. I know when I was a kid it was monsters. I think paranormal stuff scares me the most. I found Giallo as an adult, and I enjoy the gory cheese of it." Now, what Cindy said there kind of shines a light on something. There were quite a few comments suggesting that people started with a favorite genre when they were young, and it shifted. And that hasn't happened in the voting here that much. It's not like when we do what's the best horror movie of the 80s, people are like, "Well, when I was young, I loved Lost Boys, and now I've changed to Exorcist 3 or whatever. Well, not Exorcist 3, that's 90s. So, like, they haven't shifted from Fright Night to Possession. But I like that they're shifting at all. That's like a growth thing. That's really cool to see. And the main shifts in the comments were basically starting when they were young at something like slashers and or monsters, and ending when they're older at something like psychological horror. So like it's a moving to something more realistic. Lane McGaw said, is there a genre called what the fuck is that thing? I love this comment. He puts, e.g. Alien, The Ritual. I love the genre where there is something really scary, but we don't know what it is. And this is one of the gifts of this podcast and the pages to me, because now I'm going to be thinking about the what the fuck is this thing genre all the time as I watch new movies. Like Sweetheart, which was a recent and excellent sort of creature feature, but it really was, what the hell is going on here? Jason Huff had another example of migrating from one taste to another, saying, different subgenres have had their place throughout my life. To speak of these days, my wife and I both gravitate to haunted houses and found footage. Hell House LLC is the epitome of our jam. I like that vote, because throwing up the name of a movie as like the epitome of what you're talking about is a great way to illustrate it. Gabriel Headswift said, somewhere between anthology and monster horror. I love me some Tremors, and really any film that involves some form of huge monster, I'm for it. Anthology is one that has always had a soft spot in my heart, because it not only appeals to the ADHD in my head, but also they're usually films by up-and-comers that have a chance to showcase what they can do, and that's pretty badass. Now, there were a significant number of votes for anthology as a subgenre, and I loved it. And I love this reasoning for it, that there's a breed of directors that do it or try it, and identifying that that's, you know, gives it a unique feel to those kind of films. I mean, also, just structurally, it's different than sitting down and just watching a whole feature film all the way through. And then they always have like a unique challenge added in that other movies don't have to tackle. So everyone knows you can ruin a great horror movie with a terrible ending, or you can make it harder for fans to adopt a great horror movie if it's good all the way through, but you gave it a terrible beginning. But anthologies usually have to deal with like a through line. What ties it all together? And getting that third element right can make it and break it. And it makes, I didn't think of it until this topic we were taking on, where it's almost like an extra level of difficulty. It'd be like adding in a gymnastic move in the Olympics. Leslie Pre said, I like them all, but for different reasons. But if I had to narrow it down, I'd say 1, haunted house, 2, classic monsters. Looking forward to the next episode. Thanks, Leslie. That's awesome. Classics was another one that got a lot of votes, which was, you know, amazing to see. Considering just a few minutes ago, I was waxing rhapsodic about The Devil Commands when you're talking about movies from the 40s and stuff. I appreciate that the community here indulges that. I know that a lot of horror fans are bored by black and white or older classic movies, but it's just my favorite thing in the world to sit down and pull out Carnival of Souls. Or, I mean, the weird thing is there's this discussion all the time about, like, I'm never scared by horror movies anymore. They don't make horror movies scary anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I don't know. It's just me. I've watched a ton of horror movies, and I get that it's definitely less scary to me than it was when I was, like, a teenager or a kid, obviously. But if I'm in the right mood at, like, 2 in the morning, and I put on Karloff's The Mummy, and that creepy scene happens where this character's mind just snaps and breaks, and he gives like this twisted laugh, the kind of like Renfield, like insane laugh. And he's, you're watching the bandage of the mummy trail away as that laugh happens. That can still give me like a chill. Classics aren't dead to me. So when I kind of tried to count the voting up, there were definitely the top vote getters were psychological horror or terror was one. Monsters or creature horror was another. Really, if I had to pick one that I thought won, it would have been like supernatural or paranormal. And the surprises I wanted to talk about was the emergence of a lot of voting for cosmic horror and then a lot of voting for folk horror. Going into this, I didn't necessarily expect to see a lot of discussion around those two subgenres. And it wasn't just the voting. There was like a lot of passionate commenting and a lot of people who saw those votes and went after them and followed up with, you know, I support this. I didn't even think about this, but oh my God, I love these. Really tremendous to see. And the last thing about the voting here is there were some, you know, the ones at the bottom, Slasher got less than I would have expected it to. It got a decent amount of voting, but it wasn't near the top. Alien horror. So I can't remember who said this comment, but there was someone who was listing movies like Fire in the Sky and Communion and Dark Skies. And there wasn't a lot of voting for these. It was probably one of the bottom tier for sure. But with all the UFO talk happening in popular culture right now, with the weird hearings that are going on, as we're recording this episode, they just held a hearing where they were talking about having actual aliens captured and actual, you know, UFO technology or UAP, whatever we're calling this now, technology under wraps being reverse engineered by the government to make weapons out of or whatever. Like, I would expect alien horror to get a little bit of a bounce, kind of a resurgence here in the near future. So we'll see, unless it's all just a flash in the pan. Now, if I'm picking my personal favorite out of the more traditional subgenres, like a subgenre that would come up when you just searched one of the most popular horror subgenres, I sort of tipped my hand earlier. I think classics, if that would be accepted, is the one I would pick. But let's say that classics isn't, right? And let's say that we've disqualified my book genre. So, like, an inarguable genre that I think I have, like, the softest place in my heart for is haunted house. And the thing about this is I've always been fascinated by, like, structures in horror films and the way structures become characters. I feel like I know the character and the intention of the Overlook Hotel in The Shining better than I know a lot of the human characters that have been presented in, like, recent horror movies, for example. Like, it's weird. After watching Scream 5, which I didn't care for that much, and Scream 6, which I liked quite a bit, when I think about, like, the core four, the group of characters that are kind of, you know, taking the torch from the old Scream generation, I don't know that I even to this day know what really motivates them or that I could guess what they would do in a particular situation. They're still fuzzy to me, right? But the Overlook Hotel, if, you know, you sent someone, you know, damaged to stay there with their family that wasn't Jack Torrance, let's say this happened like now, I kind of know exactly how it would go. I know what the hotel would show them. It would identify, you know, things that were kinks in their armor psychologically. It would be subtle about it at first and then, like, ratchet up the intensity and the pressure. And even though this isn't, like, the haunted house genre, I also just have a fascination with the sense of place in horror movies. With that recent series from Mike Flanagan, Midnight Mass, I really felt like the place, Crockett Island, became a character in and of itself, but it just had a grip on me watching it. And I was riveted by the fact that you had such an elaborate presentation growing in the church itself, where we spent a lot of time, as it got, you know, more and more detailed and more, the decor got more interesting as the rituals got more elaborate and what they were wearing and kind of like when we were in there, it was very rich. And then you had the really spare room where Father Hill was having his essentially AA sessions and it was just really bare bones, nothing there. And somehow it really felt like there were only tiny splotches around the buildings in Midnight Mass that were lit and like a vast darkness all around encircling it. you know, whether it's Crystal Lake or it's a castle in a Hammer vampire film, or even the notoriously waterlogged Nostromo from Alien, I'm just really fascinated by the architecture of it all, and the haunted house subgenre really is the one that focuses in the hardest on that. And I'll tell you, and you're going to think I'm crazy when I say this, but I pay attention to this in a way where I feel like Christine, the Stephen King killer car movie, is kind of like a mobile haunted house. And I'm so entranced by the interior of the car, where we open up with that when it's really plain coming off the assembly line. And then as we go on in the movie, just when Christine is glowing inside at the drive-in, when she's super dark inside as the car's prowling around at the end, with poor Arnie in there thinking he's running the show, but actually just as trapped as anyone has ever been. That kind of stuff just really hits me when horror movies or shows get it right. Okay, before we close out the episode, I want to bring back something we haven't done in a while, which is the best horror movie I watched this week. Because back in the voting of the subgenre talk we had earlier, there had been a comment from Sean McCullough where he invented a subgenre he called trauma porn. He said, trauma porn or whatever, Hereditary, The Babadook, Relic, Smile, etc. are considered. And I liked that, and I had just watched Piwacket, which I think is an honorary entry in that category. But I'm going to do another movie because I feel like these movies are tied, or at least tied in terms of how much affection I have for them. And I saw right before I started recording this that the month of August, which is when this episode is coming out, is going to have two supermoons in it. When you're listening to this when the episode drops, is called a sturgeon moon, which is, I know it's for the fish, but it's odd because it reminds me of Theodore Sturgeon, who wrote one of my favorite vampire tales ever written. I think it's been a long time since I read it, but I think it's called Some of Your Blood. But of course, the whole moon talk made me think of werewolves, and the end of the month is going to have a super blue moon. I don't even know what that is yet, but presumably it's sad. So I loaded up a werewolf movie that I hadn't seen in quite a while called Bad Moon. Bad Moon is a 1996 Canadian-American horror film written and directed by Eric Red. It stars Michael Pere, Muriel Hemingway, and Mason Gamble, and the biggest star of all, Primo, the German Shepherd. Now, when Bad Moon came out, it got mainly negative reviews. It completely failed at the box office, apparently. And I just don't understand it. This is almost top-tier werewolf cinema. I mean, it's not quite Dog Soldiers or The Howling or American Werewolf, but I mean, it's at least as good as that movie Howl, which is basically the Train to Busan of werewolf movies. And more important than the fact that it's pretty damn good is also that it's pretty special as well. To bring this episode full circle, Bad Moon is based on a novel called Thor, written by Wayne Smith. And this novel is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. It's a book told kind of from the point of view of the dog. It's not like first person from the point of view from the dog, but it's like a omniscient narrator who's telling most of the story from Thor's point of view. So if you haven't seen Bad Moon, it's basically centered on just a few characters. Ted, who starts out the movie, he's working in Nepal when him and his girlfriend are attacked by a werewolf. And Ted, of course, is bitten and survives, but his girlfriend does not survive. And then to help his recovery from this event, he moves close to his sister, Janet, who's played by Muriel Hemingway, who has her son with her, whose name is Brett. And he realizes that he's been attacked by a werewolf. He's turning into a werewolf. He's trying to stop his transformations. He's trying to find a cure. But the family's dog, Thor, is incredibly suspicious and senses what's going on with Ted, and that Ted's a danger to his pack, Thor's pack, his family. And this is a movie from the writer of The Hitcher and Near Dark. So we're not dealing with, like, second-tier horror. Eric Reds had a horrible car crash into a bar where two patrons were killed, and it seems like that ended his career. So, but I don't think it's the writing or the storytelling here necessarily that makes this movie special. I think, one, it's Thor, and we'll get to that in a second, but two, it's also the look. I'd seen this a while ago, and I enjoyed it, and I thought the werewolf was really interesting looking. So the effects, you know, don't hold up perfectly, but they look pretty good. But there are some beautiful shots in this film, and I didn't remember it looking as good as it does. But it's the behavior of the German Shepherd Thor that really sets this apart. When the werewolf comes to town, so to speak, Thor does not mess around. There's a great scene where Michael Paré first shows up to see his sister. Well, she actually comes to him. He's living out of like a trailer, isolating himself, which is smart when you're turning into a werewolf. So she brings her son and her dog to come visit Uncle Ted, they call him. And when they get there, it has this setup of who's going to discover what. Like, who is Mariel going to find clues that something's going wrong with her brother? Is her son going to find clues? And he sort of does. He wanders through the trailer and finds this incredible 2,000-page book on werewolves. But Thor starts sniffing around and then heads straight out into the woods. And this is incredible because in a horror movie, what happens to the first character that wanders off by themselves to start doing a little investigating? They get killed immediately, right away. But even on the first watch of this film, where I didn't know what was going to happen at all, I had no fear for this dog wandering off. He is a force to be reckoned with. And this pattern persists through the whole movie. Like, any chance in another horror movie where a character would, like, I'm not going into that attic, or I'm not going around that dark corner, or I want to see what's happening over there, but I'm not going. Nope, not Thor. He goes straight at it, confronts the werewolf every chance he gets. There's a hilarious moment where he literally takes a piss on the trailer that Ted is living in, and Ted gets mad and goes and takes a counter piss on Thor's doghouse, which I don't think I've ever seen in a horror movie presented that way. And it sets up this really interesting dynamic as the movie goes on, where Thor can't communicate to his own family what the danger is. He's trying to tell them, follow me, come look at this, I don't think something's right. And they're just like, you know, Thor, calm down, relax, like, whatever. I mean, she's not going to suspect her own brother is going to be a threat to her, right? So he can't communicate to them, but he's doing a great job of communicating to the werewolf that he's got his eye on him and he's not going to let him get out of sight or pull anything at all. And it got me thinking, like, what other horror characters just go straight at the threat no matter what, right? Like, it's not the typical, like, Nancy in Elm Street or whatever. If she could have gotten away from Freddy initially, there wouldn't even be a thought of, like, fighting back. It would be about, you know, I'm scared to death and I just want to get out of the danger. And sure, when your personal life is threatened or someone you care about, like your parents or, you know, siblings or friends, yeah, sure, you might get a little fight in you then, but it doesn't usually start that way and it doesn't consistently stay that way. And you know who came to my mind? I mean, even Quint in Jaws turns around and goes, he's like, we're going to go get a bigger boat. And who knows if he really means it? Like, he revs up the engine and the orca breaks down, so maybe he's just planning to be stranded out there. It seems like that's it. But it's a pretty convoluted way to get yourself back into the fight, back into a confrontation. So of all things, the character of Thor reminded me of Donald Pleasance, of Loomis in Halloween. Because I can't remember any moment where Loomis isn't just heading straight at where he thinks Michael is, trying to do something about it. And I won't spoil the ending of it if you haven't seen it, but there's an epic dog versus werewolf confrontation at one point, which is just outstanding. And there's also like a fake out dream thing that happens a la Brian De Palma's Carrie or the original Friday the 13th. And it made me so mad because it's so unfair. You'll know what I'm talking about when you see it, but it just made my blood boil because Thor deserves better than these kind of suspicions, even though it sort of makes sense why you would think that, why this dream might creep into your head, but I thought it was bullshit. So if you're looking for a way better than average werewolf movie to fulfill your supermoon needs, Bad Moon is my choice. Oh, and Bad Moon also has one of the great reaction moments from a victim in horror history. The sound that this guy makes when he first sees the werewolf and then is going to be attacked by the werewolf is, I wouldn't even know how to spell it. It would have like, it would start with a W, I think. It would have a lot of vowels, but it's just an all-timer of a line delivery. So I'm so excited about this. I'm going to release this episode early so that you can, if you're subscribed, hopefully it'll hit your feed before the supermoon becomes a thing. And speaking of excited, thanks to you all, we made it. We've done it. We are now a 4.8 out of 5 rated podcast on Spotify. Thank you so much to whoever piled in with those final reviews to put it over the top. So I was celebrating as soon as I saw it. And then also a huge thanks and shout out to a couple reviewers over on the Apple platform. Samax Bites and Nahum Gardner both gave 5-star ratings and then also wrote really thoughtful things that I would find way too embarrassing to read out here. But you guys, you're listening to a far better podcast somehow than the one I'm making. But I completely appreciate the kind words. I got to tell y'all, there have been some really good written out reviews on Apple lately. And the thing that's so gratifying to me is that most of them, I think all but one of the recent ones, mentioned the community. They mentioned all of you. Nahum Gardner said as part of his review, there is a large community around the podcast online that gets real interaction with the podcast itself, has an effect on the direction the podcast goes, so the host listens as well as talks. And it's just such a great feeling for me that the people who are writing these are getting it and that they're accurately picking up on what this thing is intended to be. So much, much gratitude for that. We're still 4.7 rated on Apple because there's less ratings there than Spotify. So if you haven't dropped an Apple rating and you have it in you to do so before the super blue moon at the end of the month claims us all, that would be fantastic. And thank you, of course, to everyone in the subscriber group who helps me in a more close-in way shape the podcast and workshop ideas for it, etc. We couldn't do it without you. All right, that's it. Even a man who's pure at heart and says his prayers at night has to end the podcast sometime. Thank you for listening. Until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.